I'm Melissa Lee, and this is Fast Money. Tonight's trader lineup, Guy Dami, Tim Seymour, Karen Feinerman, and Dan Nathan. Tonight on Fast, the changing of the guard at Citi. The big bank tapping Jane Fraser to become the first woman to run a major Wall Street bank. We'll find out what is next for Citi. Plus, we've got earnings from Oracle and Peloton, both stocks on the move after reporting. We'll break down the after-hours action, and later, hitting the jackpot. Sports betting stocks on fire as the NFL gets ready for kickoff. Find out if you should take a gamble on these names. We start off with a major reversal on Wall Street, and you can see the story in the charts. Check out the S&P 500. Started the day in the green, gave up the gains around 2 p.m. to finish close to session lows. Same story for tech stocks. NASDAQ 100 giving up an early lead to finish just off its lows of the day. You saw the same thing play out in names like Facebook and Netflix, both stocks starting strong, finishing around session lows. You can extend this, by the way, to regional banks, to healthcare, to energy, to small caps. So what does the action today tell you, Guy Dami?
It's not encouraging. And, you know, I'm not going to make a big deal out of today. I try not to make a big deal of any days. Yesterday, you know, we had to show of hands. I don't think any of us really were convinced by the rally. And I'll continue to say, you know, 30 VIX suggests we're going to continue to see days of 1.5 to 2% moves. And I happen to think on aggregate, it's going to be lower. Again, you know, I'm not trying to be all doom and gloom, but the environment that we find ourselves in terms of small business, in terms of the consumer, in terms of a lot of different things as we head into the fall, on top of which an election that's probably a coin flip, I don't think is particularly bullish for the broader market, and especially on the back of a rally that's been historic. So I think it tells you that we're going to continue to do this slow move lower, in my opinion.
Yeah. Karen, what caught your eye today, and do you continue to hedge?
Well, I did raise my hand yesterday, just to clarify, because I do think all the things that caused this rally are still there. Maybe other kinds of stocks rally. Some of those parabolic ones will probably be left out. But to me, I think it was the even the skinny package that failed that sort of maybe was the catalyst for the sell-off. I'm not exactly sure of the timing of when that happened and when things started to sort of turn south. You know, I am long Facebook, I am long Apple, long Alphabet, so I didn't love seeing that, but I thought actually the banks hung in there pretty well for a down day, and we'll get more on that, but, and some of the industrial stuff. I'd look to buy some FedEx, but it really didn't move very much. I'd like to buy some of that. Things like Guy's Cat, I think they did okay. So I'm still I'm still optimistic that that sell-off was really very much about taking the froth out of some of the huge NASDAQ flyers and not the end of a bull market.
Yeah. Dan, your thoughts?
Yeah, I didn't know Guy had a cat. I know he has dogs as they bark through our show every day. You know, listen, I think what's really interesting, and it shouldn't come as a huge surprise, that what led on the downside today and the last few days that we've seen downward volatility were the very things that were defying gravity on the way up. They're heavy. They need to work off a lot of excess. I'd keep a close eye, you know, on Apple in particular. I think the panic low on Monday was about, Tuesday was about 111. You don't really want to see that break there. The S&P 500, the QQQ, the NASDAQ 100 closed just above those lows from the other day. So we don't want to see them round trip and make new lows. And I'll just mention, you know, Mel, you mentioned briefly the small caps. The Russell 2000, you know, has underperformed the entire way. It's still down about 10% on the year. And that has materially broken its uptrend from the March lows. You know, and we talk about the stimulus and you talk about skinny, you talk about fat, you know, they front end loaded all this fiscal stimulus and we don't have another package here. We have structurally high unemployment. I don't care what that 8.5% print says, it's still well above 10%. And I think the Russell 2000 is a bit more reflective of what's going on in Main Street. And Wall Street's going to work itself out over the next few weeks. And I suspect it comes at lower lows.
We may not have a stimulus package or stimulus package five or whatever number we're at this point, but we do have a Fed and we got a Fed meeting on September 22nd, Tim. So could it be Jay Powell once again to the rescue, the plunge protection team deployed to save these markets?
Yeah. PPT, and you know, so I'll remind my hand raising yesterday was a halfway. So Karen talked about her full way, and she talked about the Fed, and you know, she also said frothy. I think if you're taking a sip from that frothy mug right now, you have a little bit of a froth mustache. I think you can pull back more. I think if you look at levels from June 26, which is when a lot of these mega cap stocks, and even not the top five, but names like Square and PayPal and Nvidia ran crazy. I think those are levels that look reasonable to come back to. If you're playing the NASDAQ 100 or the triple Qs, that's around 245. I don't think you have to, and no one's going to ring that bell. We're going to probably not be able to do that here. But you have to find levels in the market. Dan talked about the 50-day and where a lot of these stocks are actually fighting and holding some ground here. But nothing has changed. I mean, today we had some jobless claims number, which still tell you the pain that's in the labor market and underscore how the economy really does need to see more reopening. Maybe we'll get that. PPI came in very hot. I think we have inflation. We talk about that, too. And at some point, that's going to be destructive for especially for fixed incomes. But for now, I think you have a case where we had to pull back. There wasn't a lot of news flow. You layer on China, layer on elections, layer on a 30 VIX, or maybe that's why we have a 30 VIX. And that's where we're going to be. I don't see us. The market's not going to get away from you on the upside in the short term.
Yeah, let's talk financials here. We mentioned showing some weakness today. We got some big news out of one of the biggest banks. Citi announcing Jane Fraser will take over as CEO next year when Michael Corbat retires. She will be the first woman to run a major U.S. bank. The move completes a leadership shakeup that has been in the works for more than a year, and it comes at a time when the bank stocks have been struggling. Citi is down 36% this year alone. For the past 5 years, it basically hasn't moved. Let's talk more about all of this with Wells Fargo Securities senior banking analyst Mike Mayo. Mike, great to have you with us. Your thoughts on Jane as the next CEO. Should we expect any real departures from Michael Corbat in terms of strategy, given she's been working so closely with the CEO and the CFO? Didn't really make too many major strategy changes as the head of global consumer.
Well, I hope we see changes with Jane Fraser as the new CEO of Citigroup. When you look at the 8-year record of Citi's CEO, you look at the stock price, Citi stock price is up 1/3. The bank index is up 1/2. And the broader market has more than doubled. So the stock price has underperformed. Citigroup today has worst-in-class efficiency, returns, and stock market valuation. The current CEO has done an excellent job to improve the resiliency of Citigroup to a point where it's stronger than it's been in decades. But when it comes to strategy, I think the current or exiting CEO has played it too safe. So I hope Jane Fraser takes a fresh look at the business mix, takes more aggressive actions. As you know, I've been on your show, and I've also gone to many annual meetings of Citigroup and said, why don't you sell off Mexico? Mm-hmm. Why don't you sell off the consumer businesses in Asia? Why don't you act more aggressive? And the biggest mistake made by Citi's current CEO is when he said a few years ago, our restructuring is over. So I hope with the new CEO, you have a fresh look and say, you know what? There's more restructuring to be done. And in Jane's background, she's not only consumer and non-US, she's also an ex-McKinsey person. So put that McKinsey hat on and say, hey, how can we restructure Citigroup to improve profitability, not just for the next year, but for the next decade?
Mike, it's Karen. Thanks for being on the show. Let me just ask you about Citigroup, but it's more broad than that. Provisions for this coming quarter. How do you think these banks are set up going into what will be probably very, very elevated loan losses? How do you think they're set up, not just Citi, but more broadly?
Well, look, for Citigroup and the banking industry, these are sobering times. I mean, you are seeing unemployment stay high. You're seeing bankruptcies. These are tough times. But let's make a distinction between costs for bad loans and the bad loan losses themselves. And that distinction, it's a subtle but huge distinction. In the second quarter and the first quarter, banks took enormous losses for future loan losses. They reserved for future loan losses. So the reserving for future loan losses probably peaked in the second quarter. So those costs are likely to come down. At the same time, you should see the actual losses go higher over the next several quarters, but not too much yet, given the degree of government intervention and forbearance. So it's shouldn't be too bad in the actual results. In fact, we think that the provisioning was so much in the first half of the year that earnings for the big banks hit a low point in the second quarter. That should be the lowest point that you'll see through the course of this pandemic, and I think that's important.
Mike, why is Citi trading at closing at $51, trading at 72% of tangible book, which according to Citi is, I think, $71.15, whereas most of the other banks are at least trading around tangible book. JP Morgan obviously trading north of that. I mean, what is Citi's problem in your opinion?
Well, their efficiency is subpar, their returns are subpar, and they've not been aggressive enough with restructuring their business mix. And even if you thought the current CEO had done a fine job, at the end of the day, you know, the stock market doesn't lie, and you're absolutely right. You're trading at 0.7 times tangible book values. That implies a huge hole in the balance sheet, which is not the case in our view. It's not like the global financial crisis when they had, you know, $50 billion of bad mortgage-related assets that needed marking down. You don't have that situation. So, you know, to us, this is an opportunity. Having said that, you lack a catalyst because you don't see enough aggressive restructuring. You have a business in Asia and Mexico and the U.S. And for when it comes to wholesale banking is global. Retail banking is local by country. And that's a failed vision of the last 100, 50, 20, 10, and couple years at Citigroup. This idea that Citigroup was going to serve that global traveler and service all their banking needs, that you have a customer in Hong Kong who sends their kids to boarding school in London and they ski in Aspen and they're going to be your super wealthy customer. That's been a failed experiment over any time frame. And that's why we call for more restructuring. And the concern with the stock trading so far below tangible book is not the sense of a hole in the balance sheet. I think it's just a concern. Can they generate returns above the cost of capital, which is a function of their business mix, which is a function of their willingness to go ahead and make the tough changes. Mike Corbett played it too safe when it came to restructuring the business mix. Hopefully, Jane Fraser will be more aggressive.
Mike, always good to talk to you. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Mike Mayo of Wells Fargo. Tim Seymour, do you like Citi more, less, or the same versus yesterday before we knew that Jane Fraser would succeed Michael Corbett?
Well, look, I love the social change here. I love the fact that Citibank's board is now going to be 50-50 gender, you know, men, male, female. And I think some of those steps, this is a move today that should not be seen as extraordinary, and yet it is. And as I'm sure many people have said today, it'll be great when this is commonplace. Citibank, the discount, I'm long Citibank, I'm long JP Morgan, I'm long Bank of America. I feel very comfortable with the balance sheets that Mike referred to. I do think that the drivers today for Citibank longer term are where they are going to extract the most value. It does seem that their commercial bank is one that is infrastructure heavy. There's probably a lot of focus on global infrastructure for Ms. Fraser going forward. I think there are opportunities to re-rate. I do think that the banks have thrown enormous provisions in the next, you know, for the last two quarters and look forward to better times ahead. But I'm waiting for that catalyst. And I will say that even before COVID-19, and I'm sure Dan's got a view on this, banks were underperforming. And they were underperforming even before they had this headwind.
Yeah, this might be more commonplace, at least on Wall Street, Karen. I mean, JP Morgan has pretty much telegraphed that the successor to Jamie Dimon will most likely be a woman.
Right. I think so. I hope it is more commonplace. Right. JP Morgan has really seemed to set up a horse race between Jennifer Piepszak, who's the current CFO, but she used to be head of card services, and Marianne Lake, who was the prior CFO, and now she's head of consumer lending. So both of them will have sort of outward-facing experience and then operating experience. They're both very young. One's 50. One, Jennifer Piepszak's 50. I think Marianne Lake's 51. So when those rolling 5 years that Jamie Dimon says he'll retire in 5 years, when one of those actually is the five-year period, it will be one of those two, and I think they're both extraordinarily talented. And for Fraser, that's great. It's not a complete shock. Maybe the timing was somewhat surprising, but I hope, as Tim said, this is commonplace at some point, and we don't need to say, wow, there's a female CEO. It's just, wow, here's the great CEO.
Right. All right, let's get to a developing story that we're following for you on Nikola. We're still awaiting a response from Nikola founder Trevor Milton to a scathing short seller report that sent shares tumbling 11% today. Hindenburg Research putting out a 90-page report that, among other things, calls Nikola a, quote, intricate fraud and claims Milton made dozens of false statements meant to inflate the EV company's valuation. The report also claims Nikola rigged truck reveals, staged misleading demonstrations. It said that it towed a truck up on the hill and filmed it rolling down the hill to suggest that it actually worked. It goes on to say that GM, which just announced an 11% investment in Nikola, didn't do its due diligence before making the deal. GM telling CNBC, we're fully confident in the value we will create by working together, and we stand by the statements we made in announcing the relationship. Nikola did fire back today, with Trevor Milton taking to Twitter to call the report a hit job, saying, cowards run, leaders stay and fight for integrity. Hindenburg is only making people love us more for trying to destroy us. It will take the rest of the day to address the one-sided false claims, but I will put out a detailed report to address it. In the meantime, troll on. It was a 90-page report, so maybe it's taking a little bit longer for Trevor to come up with this response here. But Dan Nathan, what do you make? I mean, the first response is we know, and Hindenburg did disclose, that it does have a short position in Nikola. But how is this different from somebody who's long, having taken a long position, then putting in a report saying this is the next $1,000 stock or next $3 trillion company?
Yeah, it's a tough one. I mean, I think if you look back at Elon Musk's history with Tesla over the last 10 years, he faced a lot of criticism like this. There were a lot of things thrown at him, and he took on the shorts and he won. And he even has a Jim Short line on the Tesla.com website to show for it. Listen, you know, I generally don't think, as an investor, I don't love to see founders, CEOs get in wars with shorts. It just does. It's a bad look, and it's distracting from the business. That being said, the fact that this stock gapped up 40% on that GM news earlier in the week was pretty astounding. It was, I think, obviously a pretty impressive investment, but you've had two instances where investors, the SPAC investors that brought this company public, and then GM, had the opportunity to really do the due diligence here. So to me, you know, I suspect it's probably more the same. I doubt there's fraud there. I'd be surprised.
But. Guy?
Well, this is what I'll say. I mean, to answer your question to Dan, there is no difference at all. I mean, you can do thoughtful work on the bull side and you can do thoughtful work on the bear side. The only real difference is, as many people have learned the hard way, it's a lot more difficult to make money on the short side. With that said, and I obviously have no idea the veracity or the truth, I can't speak to that, but I'll say this. GM had better hope they did all their homework and crossed their T's and dotted their I's on this one, because if they didn't, and if there is some truth in this report, the $2 billion investment will have an exponential negative factor in terms of what it means for GM going forward, in my opinion. Again, having no idea the truth, the veracity, or whatsoever in terms of the report. But if I'm at GM right now, I am absolutely burning the candle at both ends to make sure I did my homework.
Quick thoughts, Tim.
Yeah, I think one of the differences, to go back to your first question, is they're alleging fraud. It's one thing to say that a company isn't worth the valuation. We've, on this very show, had Trevor Milton on, and I think the term, you know, business plan, not business, has been used. There's a lot of allegations, including nepotism at the company, or that there's no real technology there. But it's very different than alleging fraud. And so I would just point out, I have zero position in Nikola. Ultimately, short reports like this that are very sensational are also ones that I think investors have to pay attention to as well. The guys at Hindenburg are out there, and they've done this for a bunch of people. They obviously do extreme in-depth work. So, again, it's not an attack on Hindenburg. It's to point out that there are certainly opportunities that people will get out there. But there's a difference between fraud and an expensive valuation for a company, that we're struggling with a lot of that in the market right now. Mm-hmm. And that may not be a crime.
All right. Coming up, the mother of all bubbles. That is what one of our traders is calling a key part of the economy. He'll tell us what it is and why it's got him so worried. Plus, we're following the after-hours action in shares of Oracle and Peloton, both stocks on the move on earnings, both higher in the after-hours session. Full team coverage of the results when Fast Money returns. Welcome back to Fast Money. We've got earnings alerts for you on two big names, Peloton and Oracle, both on the move after results. We've got full team coverage. Let's kick things off with Josh Lipton in Oracle's quarter. Josh.
So, Melissa, I caught up with Kirk Matern over at Evercore. Kirk covers Oracle. I want to get his quick take. He calls these solid top and bottom line results, driven, he says, by a license revenue beat and lower operating expenses. Key questions on the call, Q2 guidance, which we just got, and I'll relate to you all. More color about its competitive position in the public cloud market. When does EPS growth, Kirk wants to know, translate into cash flow growth? Of course, another big question is Oracle's interest in TikTok's U.S. operations. Kirk has actually previously written about that, says it could make sense if Oracle sees that as more of an investment, meaning find a partner and then spin out the business. In that scenario, he says Oracle wouldn't run TikTok. Instead, it really just gains a big new internet customer for its cloud business. CEO Safra Catz also giving some color here, saying our infrastructure businesses are also growing rapidly as revenue from Zoom more than doubled from Q4 last year to Q1 and this year. I have a high level of confidence, she says, that our revenue will accelerate as we move on past COVID-19. She asked for guidance for Q2, which she just gave. She says EPS growing between 10 and 14%, so between 98 cents and $1.02. Revenue growing between 1 and 3%. She says, though, the company will make no comments about press reports about TikTok. So if you're waiting for news about that, doesn't sound like we're going to get it on the call. Melissa, back to you.
Josh, thanks. Josh Lipton. Dan, what's your take on the quarter?
Good quarter. I mean, that cloud license beat was big. But the problem with this company right now is there's just no revenue growth. It's basically been flat year over year for the last 4 years. So when you look at some of the performance from some of its SaaS competitors like Salesforce that had a massive beat and the stock rallied 24% the next day, you're just not going to get that at Oracle. It's a value play for a reason. I do like it here. And I think butting up against 60 in a better market, you could play for a breakout here. And if they do happen to get TikTok for some reason and they're strategic about it, I think that would be a great asset for them to own. As Josh said, great cloud customer for them. So this quarter looked okay. I would not be selling it right here. I think it's set up pretty nicely in a better market to break out above 60.
All right, let's get over to Diana Olick with the details on Peloton's big quarter. A blowout, Diana.
Yeah, total blowout fiscal Q4 earnings from Peloton, which seems like the stay-at-home brand to beat. The fitness and streaming media company reported its first quarterly profit since going public. EPS came in at twice expectations. Revenues soared 172% from the year-ago quarter. Connected fitness subscriptions up 113%. Paid digital subscriptions up 210%. So take a look at how Peloton benefited from the new stay-at-home life that we're all in. In the company's first earnings report, it said to expect 880 to 895,000 connected fitness subscribers for the whole fiscal year. They ended up with 1.09 million, 23% more than forecast. Revenues, they expected to be 1.45 to 1.5 billion, ended up with 1.83 billion, or 24% more than forecast. The only downer in this report is that they said you can expect longer wait times for deliveries on the bike or tread for at least another two quarters. Now, one stat I also thought was really interesting, Melissa, is that the average user's workouts per month in fiscal Q4 were twice what they were in fiscal Q2. And I think I'm going to call that your pandemic stress metric. At least it is for me.
Me too, Diana. But I'm curious about that number. I saw on Twitter, Rich Greenfield over at Lightshed said that this is per household as opposed to per user. What is the distinction here in this metric?
Well, it's the number of users in your household. So I happen to know a lot of people who maybe there was one user, and then when the pandemic started, they got a whole nother set of shoes. That is, you could have three, four, five users in the same house on the same piece of equipment. So I guess that's what pushed it up a bit. But I think it's also per individual user as well. That metric was way up.
Okay. Diana, thank you. Diana Olick, let's trade this one, Karen. It's amazing. Peloton just absolutely delivered on this one.
It is amazing when you consider how high the expectations were, right? So just a couple of days ago, or it was one or two days ago, two giant upgrades, I think, to 110. And mm-hmm. So to be able to deliver on that and beat as by such a wide margin is pretty impressive. I thought that 24.7 million metric of monthly use was interesting as well. We don't know exactly who used it, how many times, but also the churn was really good at under, I think, 0.75%, so less than 1% per month churn. We'll see how that evolves as gyms open or as economies reopen. So I don't own it. I have bikes, but I don't. It's just too expensive for me, but outstanding quarter.
I mean, in terms of a metric of user engagement, I wonder why investors aren't demanding to know the average minutes per subscription per month as opposed to the average workouts per month. Because if you really want to know how engaged your user base is, it would be how many minutes you are engaged with that actual product, Guy. I don't know what your take would be or your take on the stock.
No, that's interesting. Well, look, Mel, you know this. I mean, they're all different classes. You can take a five-minute arms
right.
class.
Or a 90-minute power zone endurance, and it's all the same. It's one workout.
And that's fair. And I guess if you really wanted to break it down, I don't, and I'll push back and say I don't know how important that metric is. The fact that people are on the bike, people want the new bike. People like Dan have the treadmill, and we've said for a long time, it's not just a hardware company. I totally get what Karen's saying in terms of valuation, but I've said this for a while. I think the stock continues to grind higher from here, and I think you're going to start to see more analysts raise their price targets.
Yeah. Tim, quick on this.
Well, even more impressive when you consider they talked about a fall in gross margin because of price reductions and that 2021 sub revenues are going to be flat. Year over year. Obviously, we know what they've pulled forward, and yet the street doesn't care. So vertically integrated play, that is something that is impressive and why I think their margins ultimately are held on to.
All right. Coming up, luxurious litigation. We'll tell you about a new twist in the deal drama between LVMH and Tiffany. And later, it's game on for the sports betting stocks, what tonight's NFL kickoff means for this red hot space. Stick around. Much more Fast Money right after this. Back to Fast Money. We get a key piece of housing data tomorrow before the open. We'll get weekly mortgage bailout numbers before the bell. They could give us the real read on what's been a red-hot housing market. In fact, check out the stats. You know them. Mortgage rates are at record lows. New home sales were at the highest level since before the financial crisis. Housing starts surged for a third straight month, and home prices continue to soar. The Home Builder ETF, which has more than doubled since the March lows. But one of our traders says the housing market is on shaky ground. In fact, he is calling it the mother of all housing bubbles. Tim, this is you. So why?
Well, it's not. Yeah, I am that trader. And it's not on shaky ground right now. But the mother of all housing bubbles is certainly upon us because we're in the mother of all liquidity bubbles and credit bubbles. And thank you, Federal Reserve. Rates are at zero. Remember, before the financial crisis, rates were not at zero. They weren't even, you know, they were significantly off their highs. And we certainly had gotten to a liquidity bubble there. But if you think about the exodus out of urban centers and where people are buying homes and the fact that there are a lot of younger folks buying their first home. But the fact of the matter is the market. And the demand is extraordinary, and the ability to actually borrow against housing prices that, yes, they are going higher, but people are buying a lot of houses that cost a whole lot less than the houses they were buying 10 years ago, especially when you consider the cost of houses in urban centers versus where they are in some of these regional markets. So I think this is an extraordinary trade, and I think it still has a ways to go, in fact. But I think if you look at some of the materials opportunities within the XHB, I talked about Whirlpool yesterday, today, or Masco, or Train, or Carrier. I think these are excellent, excellent plays still, and I think those are re-rating valuations. But at some point, this will end very poorly. These housing numbers that we're seeing in terms of new home sales are extraordinary, especially when you consider where the economy is. And the same way we've seen speculation in the stock market, we're seeing speculation in the real estate market. And frankly, I think that's something people should be wary of.
All right. Well, our next guest calls housing a bright spot in the economy. Bob Nardelli is a former Home Depot CEO. He also ran Chrysler and was a GE executive and a Fast Money friend. Bob, always good to see you.
Thank you, Lewis. It's great to be with you. And if I could just pick up where Tim left off, I think, again, I shared with you earlier, I think housing is a real bright spot. And I think the demand for housing will continue for some period of time. It certainly is a seller's market. And Tim, if you look at all of the support for housing, whether it's Home Depot, whether it's Lowe's, Tractor Supply, I'm really proud. All three of those CEOs are Home Depot leadership graduates. I'm proud to say of their success. But I think this is going to continue for a while. I think with the pandemic, we're seeing people, as you said, Tim, moving out. And I think they're moving to areas where housing prices will continue to be high. But I think this has a little more leg to it, Tim. I think it really does.
So you think that the pandemic has caused changes that will last for much longer than a couple of quarters, Bob? I mean, the argument would be that people don't necessarily know what their job situation is going to be, whether they remain employed, for one, or whether or not they will be required to go back to the office, in which case having a two-hour commute to New York City doesn't really seem attractive.
Well, if you look at a recent CEO survey, so that I just take a look at, 72% of the CEOs say their employees or associates are planning on continuing this hybrid model of working from home and maybe going to the office once a week, once every other week. The other thing that you're seeing is a strong demand associated with this concept is in the used car business. You know, people are not going to be riding trains. They're not going to be riding subway. They're very concerned still about distancing. So you see the demand for used cars also being dragged along by this pandemic and this situation that we're in out there today.
Mr. Nardelli, it's Karen. Thanks for being with us. I got a question you might be uniquely situated to answer. In looking at Home Depot versus Lowe's, Ellison is about 2 years into his turnaround or restructure, whatever you want to call it. Do you think he can narrow that gap a lot more between the margins that Home Depot makes versus what Lowe's does?
Yeah. Well, if you look at Marvin has, you know, worked at Home Depot. He came in from Target when we were there, and he really has sat in a number of chairs in the home company. So if you look at where the stock was, you know, at its low at 70, trading up around 140 or something, I think recently, you can see he's already starting to restructure. He's already starting to do some things. I think he'll work heavily on merchandising and repositioning his merchandising. He'll work on branding. I think that he has the capability to certainly close the gap. I think Home Depot, of course, has got many more years. One of the advantages Home Depot has carried over Lowe's is when we were there, you know, we opened 1,000 stores and we celebrated the 2,000 store opening. So if you look at one of the real bright spots for them, and the recent surveys show that the majority of the population lives within 10 to 15 minutes of a Home Depot. So strategically, the convenience factor is there for them. I think that's something Marvin is aware of and he might be able to pick up on. It's a very good point.
Hey, Bob, it's Tim. And so to take that point, the next step, CEOs are forced to run their companies more efficiently than ever. We saw some margin inflection, companies coming out of the crisis lean and mean. What are you expecting in terms of the turn here when we finally do get the economy to reopen? And you can answer it from the broader macro, but also in terms of profitability for a lot of these companies that, you know, are elephants that have suddenly learned how to dance.
Yeah. Well, Tim, I think there's a mixed bag out there. If you look at, we were just talking about housing, certainly a bright spot. If you look at hospitality, travel industry, for example, you know, you just look at some of the big flag names like Hyatt and Marriott selling some of their facilities in prime locations. So people aren't using hotels. Air travel is still down. You're continuing to see increased levels of furloughs, both for pilots, and there were some recent negotiations there, but certainly flight attendants. And then that just rolls downhill to them. If you look at what's happening to the major airlines and then the impact on Boeing over and above what they're having with their MAX problem, that rolls down to GE Aviation, jet engine business. So I think it's really going to be a mixed bag. We talk a lot about a V recovery, but I don't think that V recovery is really affecting everyone. You look at, in your area, Tim, the restaurants in New York City. And you know, I think it's going to be a very slow recovery for them. I think there'll be some real winners and there'll be some people that won't see that V recovery. There'll be a little flat, low and slow for them.
Bob, always good to speak with you. Stay well. Bob Nardelli. Guy Dami, does this make sense that housing is so strong in the economy we have? I mean, given where claims were this morning, given where unemployment is in general?
Under those metrics, no. But then you factor in the fact that people are fleeing these big cities, looking to get out, and then it starts to make sense, coupled with the fact that interest rates are at ridiculous levels. So it all does sort of make sense. So maybe housing is a bright spot, you could say, for the wrong reasons. It doesn't matter, because if you've been in these stocks, you've done very well. And I agree with a lot of the things that Tim said and Mr. Nardelli said. I'll say this quickly. Karen mentioned Restoration Hardware yesterday, as did Tim, and we've been talking about this stock seemingly forever. Karen mentioned the short interest. I mentioned that because the stock traded close to 9 times normal volume today. So I think many of those, if not all, got squeezed out. So you've been fortunate enough to be in RH. Today was the day you pulled a ripcord and looked to buy it back cheaper. I think you're going to get that opportunity.
Yeah, the RH CEO on Mad Money tonight, by the way. And we have got a lot more Fast Money coming your way. Here's what's up next.
Sacre Bleu, new deal drama between LVMH and Tiffany. The luxury lowdown straight ahead. And later, game on. The sports betting stocks on fire as the NFL season kicks off. Should you take a gamble on these names? Find out when Fast Money returns.
Indeed, a girl's best friend, unless you are LVMH, the Louis Vuitton owner, saying it intends to file a lawsuit against Tiffany. This just a day after Tiffany sued LVMH for trying to back out of its $16 billion takeover, both stocks finishing higher on the day. So, Karen, like sands through the hourglass, the saga continues. What's your take on this turn?
Yes. So LVMH has decided to countersue. They seem to not be focusing anymore on that ridiculous letter from the French Foreign Ministry that was suggesting that they delay the merger, even though LVMH said it was legally binding. That was absurd. Now they're focusing on mismanagement, that Tiffany has been mismanaged during the pandemic, and that they shouldn't have paid dividends. I always come back to the merger agreement, which specifically allows Tiffany to pay dividends. So Tiffany will be delighted to get Arnault on the stand and question him whether he went to seek help from various ministers in France, which it sort of seems that he does. Next up, we'll see what the Delaware court says. I expect that they will grant an expedited proceeding here. And so hopefully hear that next week.
Still no letter from the French foreign minister, by the way, in all of this. We're still waiting for that.
I think they got a translated one, but not the actual.
All right. We'll see. Watch for the actual one. Coming up, are you ready for some football? These sports betting stocks are. We'll be joined by a top analyst who will break down the names you should bet on next. And what goes with football? How about some chicken wings? One options trader sees the big profits in a poultry stock. We got that trade straight ahead. Much more Fast in two. Breaking news out of D.C. President Trump just saying that there will be no extension on the TikTok deal. Dan Nathan, we were just reporting yesterday that perhaps they're going to look for alternatives to the U.S. unit actually being sold. What's your take on this?
I'm a little surprised, to have such a turnaround in such a quick time period, less than 24 hours. But it just obviously increases the likelihood that we see a real bid from Microsoft and Walmart or Oracle or whatever it is. I just don't think there's going to be a deal. And I just think it's odd that the administration is so focused on TikTok when WeChat is really the company that they should be worried about, the one that's competing with almost every major U.S. tech company here and abroad and operates under the Communist Party, over there. TikTok doesn't even operate in China. I know it's about U.S. data here, but WeChat is a much bigger issue.
All right, let's move on to gaming. Penn Gaming soaring today on an upgrade to a new street high over at Rosenblatt. That call also giving a nice lift to DraftKings, and Wall Street's betting on a big win for both stocks. When the NFL season kicks off in just a few hours from now, you can catch the first game tonight, 7 p.m. Eastern time on NBC. Let's talk more about the return of the NFL, what it means to the sports betting stocks. Joining us now is Jeffrey's gaming expert, David Katz. David, good to see you. What does it mean for the season to start, for the season to play continuously?
Well, what we know is that a majority of the sports betting that's gone on so far in the U.S. has been on football. In fact, if you look at September 2019, 69% of the wagers that happened in that month were on football. Out of New Jersey, where we only have last year to go on, I think 42% of the betting was on NFL last September. So there is an outsized amount of wagering that goes on around football. So the start and continuation of the NFL season is really critical for, testing the demand in this market.
Hey, it's Tim. Thanks for joining us. Can you talk a little bit about the relationship that, say, you know, DraftKings and some of the other online betting companies have with the respective sports leagues? And you know, are winners being chosen now, at least ones that are going to get so far ahead of the competition? Because the addressable market here is massive, and we all know we're watching sports differently and interacting with betting differently, and that states are on board with legislation, et cetera.
Right. So, look, I think you make some very important points. Number one, the size of the market, our estimate at Jefferies is $19 billion, which is a bit higher than most. And this is a story that we've been on and behind for quite some time. What we know is that, you know, the everyone is after this. This is a gold rush, right? And partnerships, investments are happening. What we don't know is what the key success factors are ultimately going to prove to be, whether it's brands, whether it's consumers and eyeballs, whether it's social engagement, or whether it's technology. And when we overlay that against our coverage and what we see here, we expect all of the above to be critically important. That leads us toward DraftKings, who has captured a lot of eyeballs, has great technology and somewhat of a proven track record through DFS. It draws us to Caesars, who has many of those parts, and we think forthcoming on the technology side. Penn has absolutely been a battleground stock in our coverage, and they have yet to roll out their app. That is going to be soft launch, as they announced yesterday, within the next week or so in one state. They absolutely have a brand and a platform that is renowned in Barstool that's hard to ignore and hard to bet against. But seeing that technology and how engaging and how productive it ultimately is the question that we're focused on.
David, always good to get your thoughts. Thank you.
Thank you.
David Katz. All right. Guy Dami, what do you say about this space?
DraftKings is the place to be. I think it traded up to $44.79 in the beginning of June, tested that level today. So you obviously have a bit of potential for this double top. I think it's going to blow through it. I think Evercore just initiated with a $60 price target. Disney would never do this in a million years, but it makes so much sense for their for them to buy a product like this for their ESPN distribution. It would be a tremendous asset for them, in my opinion. But I think these stocks are real. And, you know, the Michael Jordan news was important. Mm-hmm. But I think regardless of what happens with sports this year, these stocks are here to stay. And I think DraftKings is the place to be.
Karen, you've leaned towards Penn. He basically, David Katz, basically self-would-you-rathered and went to DraftKings. And we saw the stock gain about $800 million in market cap on the Michael Jordan announcement alone. So how do you feel about Penn versus DraftKings at this point?
Well, I mean, they've closed the gap. I mean, I think it was the stock was, what, 32 when Portner was talking about the differential between the two is just way too wide. Obviously, that gap has closed, so this point, I don't know. I found sort of a cheaper, much sort of a little different spin on it, which is MGM. I believe in Barry Diller. I think he will be very important in helping them with their online gaming.
And a reminder here, the NFL season kicks off in just over an hour from now when the Texans take on the Chiefs. You can catch the kickoff 7 p.m. Eastern time on NBC. Coming up, option traders are beefing up bets on this beaten down name. Should you sink your teeth into this stock? We got the trade. And let's take a sneak peek at the Cramer cam. And there's Jim chatting with the CEO of RH. You can catch that full interview top of the hour in Mad Money. More Fast Money right after this. Welcome back to Fast Money. Check out Tyson Foods surging on news that the company will begin working to verify the sustainability of beef production on more than 5 million acres of cattle grazing land. Over in the options market, traders are betting this ESG play can lead to sustainable gains. Mike's got the action. Mike.
Yes, on an otherwise weak day, this is one of the stocks that saw a little bit of strength, and we saw that in the options markets too, where it traded three times the average daily call volume, and in fact, calls outpaced puts by about 8-1. And one of the places we saw that activity was the September 66.5 calls. We saw 1,000 of those trade for about 40 cents. Buyers of those calls are obviously betting that the stock could continue that strength and rally through the 66.5 strike price by at least the 40 cents that they paid. That would put the stock above 67 or so by the end of next week, betting on continued strength on the back of that news.
All right. Thanks for that, Mike. Mike Coe, for more options action, be sure to tune into the full show. That's tomorrow, 5:30 p.m. Eastern time. Up next, final trades. We'll be right back. for the final trade. Let's go around the horn. Tim Seymour.
Mel, KC's given 9.5. Are you taking that action?
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
Come on. Are you definitely. Well, Citibank, if you're playing with Citibank here, it feels like you're getting 9.5 points. I think trading at a discount. Obviously, Jane Frazier is going to do a great job, and I think there's a lot of restructuring in the tank. Buy it now.
It took me like 5 beats to think of what KC was actually referring to. Karen.
Yeah, I just want to second what Tim said. I can't wait for the day where a female CEO is just referred to as a CEO. But that aside, my final trade is Lowe's. I do think that there is room, even if they don't get to the Home Depot margins, for all the reasons Bob Nardelli said, there's still room to go. So I like Lowe's.
Dan Nathan.
Yeah, Bears over Lions in week one, Mel. I'm going to go with Viacom CBS here. I think this is a cheap asset. This stock acts really well for a stock down 30% on the year. Looks like it's breaking out, wants to get back towards 40.
Guy Adami. We didn't
hear your dogs tonight. You know, Dan got on my dogs. Yeah, that's exactly right, because I have them sequestered like Charles Van Duren, for those of you playing our home game. They were put in a separate room. So you didn't hear Rocky or Russell today.